एचडी स्मार्ट कास्ट।
यू आर लिसनिंग टू एन एचडी स्मार्ट कास्ट ओरिजिनल।
हेलो एंड वेलकम टू सीजन टू ऑफ Dreamers and Unicorns, a HT Smartcast original. Now, this is a show about leadership, talent, culture, skills, and everything that shapes our world of work. In each episode, you will meet a dreamer or a unicorn. So, who is a dreamer? Of course, you know that one. I know you will say that anyone with an unfulfilled dream is a dreamer. But who is a unicorn? Well, you know, think about it like this. A unicorn is the next big thing. Everyone talks about them. You know, they attract admirers and leave us wondering, how do they do it all? They take the road less traveled, and that becomes a source of inspiration to everybody else. In this podcast, I want to acknowledge and thank our knowledge partners, the Society for Human Resources Management, which is the voice of everything which is important in the world of work. Our other knowledge partner is TAGGD, that is TAGGD, a digital ready platform that makes talent acquisition on demand a reality. And me, I am Abhijit Bhadri. I work with organizations and leaders on their leadership, talent, and culture. This is just the subject of a book that I've recently written, which is called Dreamers and Unicorns. I also coach individuals who are navigating shifts in their career.
Well, actually, I was traveling alone. And, you know, it was back in the day when we sat in the train and people struck up conversations. So this man asked me, you know, young man, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to play. So what are you going for? Eventually he got around to asking, so what do? You study or something? And I said, no, I'm a chess player. And he said, yes, but what do you do? So I'm a chess player or whatever. I think it there must have been something along the lines of, but your father has a company, you know, this kind of stuff. So he could see what was in his mind. And then at some point he said, well, young man, don't take this badly. And, you know, sports is a very unpredictable career. And if you wanted to, you should really think twice before you take the plunge. I mean, if you were Vishwanathan Anand, I remember the words fairly clearly. If you were Vishwanathan Anand, then you could make a living playing chess. But otherwise, I would think twice about it.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to season two of Dreamers and Unicorns. And when I have to introduce today's guest, I'm going to give you a couple of hints. First of all, here is a person who's won Padma Shri, Padma Bhushan, Padma Vibhushan. And then, of course, if I were to say the person has had a planet named after him. And then, of course, if I have to say that this person has won the chess Oscar multiple number of times, well, then it's a giveaway, because then we are talking of just one and only Vishwanathan Anand. He likes to be called Vishy. So, Vishy, welcome to Dreamers and Unicorns. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, nice to be here.
Vishy, I'm going to start by sort of asking you a couple of basic questions about different aspects of the game. And, you know, have you been watching Queen's Gambit? I know you've done a couple of reviews I saw on Instagram. But, you know, what was your reaction when you look at that film, The Queen's Gambit, on Netflix? What was your take?
The thing that struck me the most was how accurately it depicts chess. I mean, they've taken the chess bit and made it something insiders don't have to score on that. So that's the thing that leaps out at an insider. Incidentally, I had a conversation with a friend. I mean, it's a common chess lament that whenever chess is portrayed in, let's say, an ad or a movie, it's terribly inaccurate. The pieces are set up wrongly, first of all. Second, mate happens in a position where even if you can't see the board, you understand that the king is in much too open an area for it to be checkmated and things like that. So chess players tend to latch onto this. And this time they painstakingly not only paid attention to these details, but they got the entire games in. I mean, there are entire stretches which you can give as puzzles, like I did in you can actually even study these positions afterwards, find them, and all that was very well done. Now, that's from a chess player's perspective. More broadly speaking, I think they have captured both the chess scene in the US in the 50s and 60s, because that's what the book is based on. I mean, the author passed away in 84, as I understand. So, in a sense, the book has got to be frozen there. They have incorporated chess games from later years. Like there's one game from 1993, which is the final one. Then there's a game from the year 2000 and details like this. But it captures that. And you know, when you do 50s and 60s, you immediately go for Bobby Fischer. And you think that's what it's about. But Death is not a boy, he's a girl. She's a girl. And second, she doesn't end up like Bobby Fischer. So there's a lot to do with Bobby Fischer, but you start to look for other things. There's a bit of Lasker, there's a bit of Capablanca, and you know, it's very nice. Even the US chess scene, the Las Vegas Open, all that is captured beautifully. That for me doesn't explain why the show has 62 million views on Netflix. It's insane the effect the show has had. So clearly it speaks to something that non-chess players find appealing. And to be honest, I'm struggling to place exactly what. I don't know what it is that they love. Maybe you should tell me, because I don't know what it is they like so much about the show. It's definitely a nice show, which I recommend people watching. But it really seems to capture their imagination.
For me, I think it is about the ability to deconstruct the game. In many ways, you know, they kind of explain a lot of the terms, which can, you know, if you start to discuss it, then, you know, this is an opening. This is what it's called, Sicilian defense. You know, it's done in a very, very beautiful style of storytelling. So for me, that's really what works. But I would be keen to know that, you know, there's another, you know, typical, a very, very strong film based on chess, Shatranj Ke Khiladi, which Satyajit Ray had done. Did you get to see that? I mean, and, you know, that's the one other chess game based movie that I can think of. Did you see it? And do you have any comments on that? I mean, you talked about accuracy. Ray was known for his finickiness about being accurate.
I didn't see the movie entirely, so I can't answer that well. But, I mean, at least till Queen's Gambit, in India, if somebody wanted to talk to you about a chess movie, that was the name that came up. I mean, everyone would immediately bring up Shatranj Ke Khiladi. So, very much I had the fortune of meeting him, but I did not see the movie in its entirety.
So, and what was that like? Was it during the making of that film or no?
No. I met him when I had gone to Calcutta for a chess tournament.
Okay.
And then the organizer said, you know, would you like to meet him? Are you kidding me? So, of course, I went. We spoke briefly and, well, for me, it was just meeting a legend.
Is it true that introverts do better at chess than extroverts? Is that accurate? How would you describe yourself?
I don't see myself as particularly introverted, but all chess players have this ability that, by the way, Beth Harmon has as well, which is sometimes to forget the rest outside world. That doesn't particularly mean that we are introverts. Let's put it this way. Chess players, you know, span the gamut, but a lot of what we want to talk about is captured in notation and things. It's a secret language. And so it's possible that outsiders perceive us as more introverted than we are. I mean, until recently, you could even call chess players a member of some cult. I mean, after all, these are people who can sit in a dinner table and play our entire game in their heads just with moves. This is also, by the way, brought out in the
Yes, today. Absolutely.
Really emphasize that. Other professions have it as well. I'm sure you get some doctors together and they get going. But once they get going, it does sound inexplicable to me. You can see that they're not introverted, but you still see that you can't follow the conversation. The same thing in many professions. I think mathematicians probably, when they get to tear away from the others and get to be amongst themselves, they really like to let go. No, I don't think but chess certainly forgives an introvert. There is no particular handicap in chess for being an introvert. So maybe that's the factor. But chess players, yeah, we think about chess a lot and we can be obsessive.
I started the conversation with Vishwanathan Anand by asking him about this mini-series on Netflix called Queen's Gambit. Have you seen it? It is starring Anya Taylor-Joy and is about a fictitious chess prodigy called Beth Harmon. I was struck by two things about Vishwanathan Anand as he talked about the chess series. One was that he's able to take a look at the chess pieces in a scene, which actually shows up for just a fraction of a second, and he's able to reel off the match that would have inspired that particular scene. you know, the position of those chess pieces individually. You and I may have seen it as well, but wow, what an amazing memory that calls for. The second thing was his quiet confidence, where he talks about the chess players practicing their art almost in a cult-like fashion, spending an entire evening at the dinner table playing all the moves in their head. These two sides, the ability to recognize patterns and practicing, actually explains Vishwanathan Anand's rapid playing speed even as a child. He was called the lightning kid. And sometimes an expert loves his or her craft so much that the line between work and play simply disappears. And when you, you talked about visualizing the game in your head, is that a stage of transition that you first start by being able to see the board and you remember a bunch of games and moves, and then at some stage you are able to play it, a couple of moves forward. So is that how it happens in your head? What was your...
Very much. It gets faster and faster. And you get slightly lazier. I mean, chess players are lazy to... every time we want to discuss something, we are lazy to put up the chess set on the table, set up the pieces, and then get to the position. The minimum we are willing to do is we'll set up the position we want to talk about straight away. We won't make the moves leading to it. But when I was young, I guess already by the age of 8 or something, I had gone from taking a chess magazine, putting a chess set, and playing through them to just reading the magazine and following the thing in the board in my head. So you get there very fast, and it doesn't even mark you out particularly. It's a fairly common ability to be able to discuss a chess game in your head.
And when you become a grandmaster, what does it really mean? How do you know that you're a grandmaster? What is that sequence like?
A grandmaster is basically a title, like a doctorate. And just like for a doctorate, you present your thesis and your thing. To become a grandmaster, you have to perform at the level of a grandmaster two to three times. And these individual bits are called norms, grandmaster norm. And when you have completed 24 games, then, and there are one or two other criteria, you must get your rating to a certain level. So you cannot just make your norms and then let your rating collapse. You've got to hold that up. But once you've done that, then you give the application, the World Federation checks and approves. So essentially, that's what it is. It is not an easy title to get. And so there is still a big sense of achievement in getting there. Once upon a time, when I was trying for the GM title, I was the... No Indian had become a GM. So then, in conversation, Grandmaster had the function that sometimes the Olympic gold medal has for us. How can a country like India not have any grandmasters was the common way the question was phrased. So at that point, it had an extra prestige attached to it. Now it's still a great title, but we have more than 65 grandmasters.
India had to wait until you turned, 17 or 18 before you became a grandmaster?
Well, I made my first norm the day of my birthday. So I just turned 18.
11 December.
11th December, that's right. And my second norm was 2 weeks later. Three weeks later. So literally those two norms clinched it for me because they were 13 and 11, so I got to 24. And then I became a grandmaster. And it was nice because I'd been trying to get these norms for about 2 years, but it just went like... When it happened, it finally was over in a month, and very nice feeling. Obviously, it was very special. I remember for the first time... No, actually the second time, because I had won the World Junior a few months before, and that was when I first... got my first exposure in the press and so on, even made covers of magazines and things like that. And a grandmaster was the second time that happened. So I became, let's say, comfortable with the idea of being slightly famous, and that really came with a grandmaster title.
At age 18, how does one learn to handle fame? Because yours was disproportionately high. I mean, you were the first grandmaster in India, and it was, a big deal. So what were those moments when you had to make those choices?
I can't remember the first time it happened, but it's mostly just pleasant and fun. It's literally the sensation of being at an airport and having a casual stranger struck up a conversation, and then suddenly he realizes, or people recognize you from the newspaper and they say, oh, you think I'm this and I followed that. it's not particularly a burden. It's, you know, I got to deal with the fun side of fame. Clearly, my fame wasn't the gossip journalist, you know, the yellow tabloid kind of fame. And yeah. We should now consider this a blessing. That was well before social media. So I think fame has a different meaning now almost. But those were very innocent times, it seems to me. And I wore it lightly. I enjoyed it. And every once in a while, it made your life easier. And I wouldn't say that I complained.
And, you know, I've heard that one time, you know, your father and you were traveling in a train and somebody said, you can't make a living unless you are Vishwanathan Anand. Tell us about that. I mean, I have very sketchy information on that. What really happened?
Well, actually, I was traveling alone. And, you know, it was back in the day when we sat in the train and people struck up conversations. So this man asked me, you know, young man, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to say, what are you going for? Eventually, he got around to asking, so what do you do? Do you study or something? I said, no, I'm a chess player. And he said, yes, but what do you do? So I'm a chess player. That's what it is. I think it there must have been something along the lines of, but your father has a company, you know, this kind of stuff. So he could see what was in his mind. And then at some point, he said, well, young man, don't take this badly. And, you know, sports is a very unpredictable career. And if you wanted, you should really think twice before you take the plunge. I mean, if you were Vishwanathan Anand, I remember the words fairly clearly. If you were Vishwanathan Anand, then you could make a living playing chess, but otherwise I would think twice about it. And of course, I did not tell him.
Why didn't you? You should have.
Well, if someone else had been sitting next to me and had pointed it out, I would have enjoyed it. But bring myself to say this. It's almost like explaining it. So I decided to just leave it there. And it's one of the nicest stories I can imagine.
How did your dreams about the game change in terms of, you know, how you visualized the pinnacle that you would achieve? And how did that evolve and change? Because at some stage you would have gone past the role models. What was that like?
But it happens gradually and you get used to everything, right? When I was starting out at a very young age, many people told me that when they would ask me what you hope to become in chess, I would always say world champion. And for me, it was not even an answer that I gave with some cockiness or arrogance. It was not like, you know, I evaluated myself. It was, I answered the question, what do you want to become, in the same way that what is your dream? And that is how I answer the question. In practice, every stage I got to was already more than I expected, per se. When I became a grandmaster, that felt very nice. And, you know, already I was an unknown territory. And by this point, there was no real sense of failure anyway. Everything you knew, you had almost been the first to do it, in first Asian or first Indian. And I didn't feel any pressure or nothing like that. I don't even think I really knew what was involved in the journey. So it allowed me to go in that journey just thinking, well, let's just see how far we get. And it's this feeling when you finally climb the top of the mountain and you see that phenomenal view. Well, at least for the mountain, you know, you expect to see a phenomenal view. But for me, it was literally any point I would have gotten that far, it would have been great. I would have still been a chess player. I would have had a pretty glorious career for it by my expectations, and that's all it was. I think the second or third time I tried for the world title. So my world title, the first cycle I attempted was 91, 93. The second one was the one right after that, 93 to 95. And then I had a further attempt in 98. By 2000, I could feel the pressure of public expectations. You know, it was past this thing of, well, you've broken barriers and you're a trailblazer, fine, yeah, we know all that. But when are you going to do it? And you could sense this even in people's attitudes to you. Like, they no longer bothered with the disclaimer, oh, you know, it's amazing what you've done so far, but they would straight away get to the point. So when are you going to do it? And that feeling started to grow When I finally became world champion, I think I felt the pressure and the relief of expectation, but not much before that.
The career path of Vishwanathan Anand brings up a very interesting dimension. When he was a kid, he would always say, I want to be a world champion. Now, this does not sound very different from the kid who says, I want to be an astronaut or I want to be a doctor. But then, very rarely do you come across children who have such a specific goal set so early in life. And more importantly, they stick to it. Then comes the unicorn phase where Vishy starts getting noticed. Strangers strike up conversations and some even advise him not to take up chess. Unless, of course, he is Vishwanathan Anand, then, of course, it doesn't matter. There is the burden of expectations of a nation. When will you become a grandmaster? Remember, this is really like asking a 17-year-old, when will you get your doctorate? He actually delivers on that promise. In his case, Vishy became a grandmaster at age 18, and this is when he moved from being a unicorn to really becoming a market shaper. In 2007, he became the first sportsperson to get the Padma Vibhushan. Personality plays a major role in career success or failure. And Vishwanathan Anand talks about it in the next segment. So don't go away. You know, you've played in many, many formats. Look at speed and intuition. Now, does that speed come from the fact that you have a certain number of games already worked out in your head? And if so, what's that number of games one needs to have to get the kind of speed you do?
Lots of chess players who think quite fast. And then, I mean, there is no typical chess personality. You have every kind. You have the patient, worrying kind. You have the people who are impatient, impulsive, they're intuitive. So the ones who are impulsive to begin with continue being that way. And I was very much in that category. So as I got better, my moves would come faster. But it's true that I was one of the most extreme in this sense. I know that even historians would say, yes, there were fast people before, but you're insane or more. When I was young, there were games I played very, very fast. And a lot of mistakes did creep in. So over time, I evolved to be slightly slower than what I used to be. But in chess, mistakes are, they're not mistakes unless somebody finds them. So, there are other players who play quite fast. It's a pattern of, it's a thing of personality. And when you see the thing is, the more games you play, the idea just pops in your head. You don't have to work it out. You don't have this logical way of thinking where I list what are my possibilities and then I work out the best one. The best one will pop into your head, you'll fall in love with it, you'll play. That's kind of how it goes. And that's the kind of player I was.
Like everything in sports, there is a point of time when you win and then there is a point of time when you lose. Tell me about how do you handle both? I mean, how do you handle victory? How do you handle defeat?
Well, I've had enough of both that over time you get used to, you tell yourself at least that this has happened before. But a defeat is a terrible blow. And there are so many times in a tournament where I feel gutted. And what I do is I realize it's more important to recover emotionally than technically. So this means that rather than sitting and working on your thing, what you've got to do is maybe give yourself the evening off. I mean, if you tend to train in the evenings and then get ready, you have a routine. The day at the point, time after a defeat is when you just throw it to the four winds and you just follow whatever routine you want. You might go for a long walk, you may skip work. You'll generally be annoyed with yourself and you know it's better to let go till you recover. At the other end, winning, you sometimes you don't want to put the game behind you because you're so excited about it. And the problem is, in both cases, after a defeat and after a victory, there is probably another game to play the next morning, the next day. And your job is to get back to earth before that game starts. Both euphoria and depression are bad. So you need to find a way to put the previous day's events behind you. Typically, I say that the best method is if you can get a good night's sleep. By this, I mean a night's sleep where my brain isn't thinking about all the things that happened over and over like a movie. So if you can block those thoughts out, that's the best.
One of the things that I've seen is that
or at least I've read about on the internet, is that spot in the movie The Queen's Gambit, where you know she doesn't have a clock, that was actually taken from something that has happened to you. Is that correct?
Yes, I had that experience when I played in the U.S. And this is not common in other countries, but in the U.S. they have this thing of there's an organizer, and he will simply announce a tournament, by which it means that he guarantees the prize fund, and then it's a business proposition. He tries to collect it from the entry fees, and you know he tries to come out ahead. And quite often they will not have all the chess sets and clocks, so participants are encouraged to bring their own to the tournament hall and use them. And so I had no clue. When we played in the Tal Chess Club, we were flooded with chess sets and clocks. So I just went to the game, and then he said, well, you'll have to wait for someone to finish, and then you can ask them if you can borrow their clock. And I could hardly believe it. And again, that's one of the things. I mean, clearly, they capture the US chess scene very well. And this is what one of the things I meant.
So, you know, now sort of look at the way that you've become fairly synonymous with the game in India. And of course, internationally, you sort of make your mark like any market shaper. In some sense, our career also follows the three stages: dreamer, unicorn, and market shaper. You've been 5-time world champion. You've retained the world championship thrice. What has changed inside you as you look at your journey? You know, you as a person, as you started off and now, what is fundamentally the shift that the game has created in you?
The biggest sense I feel is that when I started out, I was entirely a pioneer, and almost on a daily basis, because after I became a grandmaster, after I became world junior champion, I became a grandmaster. After I became a grandmaster, I mean, I would literally do one small thing after the other, and I would realize I was the first Asian to do it, something like that. And even in India, well, enthusiasm for the sport had started to build. You know, people were still curious and they were inquisitive. They wanted to know more about what you did. You always had the feeling you were planning this, you know, from scratch. And nowadays, in India, the game has changed. I mean, we have so many grandmasters. We have a pretty vibrant chess community. Internationally, the fact that this monster chess superpower that used to exist, the Soviet Union, is now 15 different countries, and Russia is pretty good still.
But, why? What is so special about? Everybody talks about the fact that you have to defeat the Russians. That is seems to be the ultimate port to conquer. Why is it like that?
I think they were the first professionals. In this sense, the communist state actually gave them the opportunity to make a living off chess. You know, not the capitalist living, not the millions of dollars running into your bank account, but nonetheless, they were given a flat, a stipend, and the opportunity to play as much as they wanted, because the state felt it should subsidize these kind of rich cultural activities. And so when the rest of the world, people had to often think, literally had that train conversation. Should I now leave my university job and pursue chess, but then I'll be dependent on winning these tournaments every month, and I'll have to do this and do that. Can I find some other avenue which will support me? Can I have a part-time job? Or maybe coach players. And you always need to balance this in the rest of the world. In Russia, in the Soviet Union, they didn't need to do that. The state guaranteed them a living, and so they were able to concentrate all their energy on being chess. Gradually, that has changed. The biggest contributor to that change was probably Bobby Fischer, in the sense that he started the revolution which allowed chess players in the rest of the world to earn a living playing chess. That's one more big change. And generally, the game of chess has been dramatically impacted by both computers and communication. The fact that now chess is available instantly everywhere. You can follow every tournament on your phone.
And
sometimes I have to strain to remember stories like, you know, I went to the reception, asked the room number of some participant, because somebody else had told me that participant had a copy of the magazine where last month's tournaments were available. And then you went and you knocked on his door and said, you know, can I borrow that magazine? It's very hard to even remember these kinds of situations anymore, because everything is available instantly to everyone. And that's maybe the biggest difference in chess.
has it raised the overall standard of the game, or has it commoditized some stuff? What has it done? How has technology shaped the life of a sports person, a chess player specifically?
Probably both. What has happened is that it's dramatically raised the level of chess coaching, ability to find opponents, practice, and inevitably people get good at the game. They get much better. The problem is if enough of them do, cruel word, isn't it? Commoditized. But on the other hand, if enough of them get better, then you have to keep moving the signposts. I think you can fairly confidently say that you can play in an open tournament today and your opponents are more dangerous than they used to be 30, 40 years ago. The top GMs were very good then. How far you could, how far down you could go before you were totally safe from having to worry about being defeated. Now it's more unpredictable. There's much more time. You can almost say with certainty, there's no way I would lose.
When you think of a tournament, a really global tournament, how long does that preparation work take? I mean, how do you prepare for it? How many months or weeks or whatever does it take? So, for example, if you're somebody says, I want to aim to be a grandmaster. How long is that journey going to be like?
Well, chess knowledge is something you're constantly acquiring. In fact, if you go a month or two, then just like any muscle, it atrophies a bit and you're a bit slower when you come back. So chess knowledge, once you start competing, you probably want to do it on a regular basis all the time. And that kind of knowledge is also not targeted. You're not saying, I want to use this only against one opponent.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a huge bank that you can draw from. You're building up your bank account, and then one day you'll need it, and you remember, oh, I have that thing in the thing, and I can get it out, and you use that, and so on. So you're constantly increasing your knowledge. Then for a tournament, you will fine-tune what you need. So you'll take your opponents, make databases of each one of them, say, okay, first, this one, if I play white against him, what is it I want to be doing? If I play black, what can I aim for? And so you'll need a sense of what they've been doing recently, what you can target, what you want to avoid, all that sort of thing. And here you're doing specific preparation for each one. But this work is useless unless you have built up that bank of general ideas from which you'll be able to draw the appropriate one. And so the more work you do in general terms, the easier it is to prepare for a specific one. Because chances are you'll have some little weapon somewhere that will work against that player. And that's really... So there are matches where I've spent 3-4 months with a team of 4 players working 9-hour days, just preparing to be ready for the match, because I know that my opponent will be doing the same. That's overkill for a chess tournament. Actually, chess is a good example of the thing where you need to know even what you don't need to know. You need to know something in order to know that you don't need it. So you'll have to keep on looking at positions you don't play, positions you don't aim for, structures that don't often occur in your game. It's helpful to keep an eye out, see if something interesting is happening, test your level against it. If you're bad at something, try to improve on it. Because one day will come when that option will be valuable. And it'll be nice to have it handy. But if you have never studied it, you may not even know that option exists. So, you've got to keep on working on all areas because you never know which one will turn out to be useful or necessary.
One of the things I've never heard anyone saying, and I'm going to make a note of this in my head, which is that you need to know even what you don't need to know. Isn't that an amazing way to look at how to build expertise? So, even what he doesn't need to know, if even Vishwanathan Anand works so hard at constantly improving his chess moves, it really serves as an inspiration. In my book, Dreamers and Unicorns, I talk about market shapers and incumbents. If you look at any of the incumbents in any field, there are organizations or people who have stopped learning. And all their stories are all about their past days of glory. But staying relevant and staying innovative every single day is important, even when you are a grandmaster in chess, just like Vishwanathan Anand. So someone at your level, what do you aspire to do something in the same game, or do you now wish to take up something completely different in the sport, or do you want to do something different going forward in sense of something that will give you a sense of achievement that I've now got, or do you feel you've done it?
Well, first of all, the landscape keeps changing very fast. I mean, chess gets younger and younger, newer players are appearing all the time, they're doing interesting stuff. So even like a treadmill, staying in your position in chess requires a lot of work and a lot of things to improve. In my case, it's true that most things I've done at least once, so it'll be hard to pretend that I can do something now. But you still feel I did well in this tournament, I beat these young rivals, you know, I had a good performance. That still means a lot. You cannot get tired of chess tournaments simply because you won one or two. So you can always find new mini goals. Say, you know, all my life I never played this kind of structure. Let me try it and see if I can understand and play it well. So you can learn new things and things like that. Besides that, I'm also trying to work with some of our youngsters and passing on some of my experience and knowledge. And that's a nice new thing to do. I've tried doing commentary at chess tournaments. And wow, that's been fun. Actually, I did it at the beginning. In 91, I became, in 88, my first breaks were as commentators, not as a player. But of course, subsequently, I went to a tournament mostly to play in it. And so recently, it was nice to commentate online. I'm sort of answering the question what I was doing in the pandemic as well, but same general principle.
You know, I'm just curious, when a planet gets named after you, what does it really mean? Because I know you also have a deep interest in astronomy. Where does that come from?
I grew up with Cosmos, Carl Sagan, and I always liked the book, and it's fascinating. And well, astronomy is one of these subjects. The hook is at the beginning, you know. As you get more interested in astronomy and you read about the discoveries are being made, it's still nothing prepares you for that mind-altering impact that it has in the beginning. The first time you hear the distance from the Earth to the Sun, let's say, converted in some meaningful unit that you understand. If you were to walk from your house to your school, I don't know, 50 million times or something like that. And then finding out that other planets exist which can swallow the Earth 1,000 times, and that other stars exist and swallow the Sun 1,000 times, and the distances are mind-boggling. And I think astronomy gets its impact over at the beginning, the best bits, the really mind-blowing bits it gets at the beginning. But anyway, and also my cousins and me used to sit and discuss these things, whether we could colonize other planets, and a little bit of childish stuff there. But in 2015, it caught me off guard because it was announced on April the 1st. And my first reaction when a lot of people would call me and tell me this is I would show them, no, it's a practical joke. You know, I even know the Chess magazine which does this. It's a practical joke and so on. And then it turned out that, in fact, it wasn't a practical joke. And then I had to read up about it. So what happens is that they're constantly discovering small asteroids and minor planets, these sort of things. And eventually a lot of them build up. So then the IAU allows people to send in suggestions as to what you can call it after, kind of getting public interest. And there was somebody who worked in the Planetary Centrum, was a chess fan, a man called Michael Rudenko. And he said, well, I know Anand's interest in chess, let me put his name forward. And so he did that, and in the next batch of approvals, I got approved. And that was very nice. And for a while, I was sitting every day and going to a web page where you could track where I am supposed to be right now. I found out that I'm at about minus 220 degrees. Wow. So I'm pretty cold out there.
But you're a pretty cool guy.
Yes. And so on. And I'm really flattered. I wrote a letter to him to thank him.
What is
what
the planet
I
called?
It's called Vishyanam 4538. That's the number, and then it's Vishyanam 4538.
Awesome. So, you know, I could, of course, go on talking to you about one last question. How come you got interested in learning German, Spanish, and French? You know, you have a penchant for learning languages. And when did you learn this? What age was that? And what drove you to it?
Okay, French I simply learned in school. It was nice because we heard that French, they awarded marks more liberally, so I signed on for French. And that is probably the weakest of my languages because I studied French, but as is typical for something you learn in a school, if you don't use it much, it kind of just stays there. At some point, I traveled to Spain for the first time and I met a couple there, and they were incredibly good friends of mine, almost second parents. And slowly the idea started to form that maybe I could settle in Spain. You know, I needed a European base for my career, and maybe I could settle in Spain. Roughly the period for a few months before buying a place, and then afterwards, I started to work on my Spanish. And that got better because I really did not sit and learn it formally. I just learned it by speaking to people. Well, it's easily the best of my foreign languages. I learned it in the most natural way. And about, 7-8 years later, I got an offer to play in a German chess club. And I also had a very close friend of mine in Frankfurt. And so, invariably, my plans would involve landing in Frankfurt, meeting up with this friend, and then going from there to this club there, wherever the club was playing. And then I got the idea, well, why not just pick up some German? I mean, German is similar enough to English that you recognize a lot of the words. And so it was just a small step from that. My German is a decent second to my Spanish, but I think still my Spanish is the best of the three.
Well, Brigitte, thank you ever so much for all the time that you've so generously spared for our listeners. And I'm sure that they'll have plenty more questions. If they wanted to connect to you, where can they find you?
I think my email should work. Vishy64 at Gmail.
And of course, on social media, do you want to give out your social media handles where they can follow you?
Yes, it's Vishy64 the King, modestly. Vishy64 the King is my Twitter handle. I think once you get to Twitter, you'll find my other accounts as well. I have a Facebook page and an Instagram.
Thank you so very much. And I wish that you would forever, even though you're a market shaper, I would always wish that you would stay a dreamer at the core of yourself. Thank you very much for being with us. And that brings us to the last episode of season 2 of Dreamers and Unicorns. And if you've enjoyed the show, do rate us on the podcast platform where you've heard this episode. You can follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram at Abhijit Bhaduri. That's Abhijit Bhaduri, or email me at abhijitbhaduri@live.com. That is abhijitbhaduri@live.com. We will see you soon for yet another season of Dreamers and Unicorns. Until then, stay connected, stay curious. Goodbye.
So don't forget to tune in. Dreamers and Unicorns 2.0 has been produced by HT Smartcast. To give it a listen, log on to htsmartcast.com अरे सुनिए जरा नए नजरिए से क्या फिर मिलते हैं जल्दी.
दिस वॉज एन HT Smartcast ओरिजिनल
HT Smartcast.